This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2009 podcast series. Today we're speaking about roles and relationships with clients, or what we used to call dual relationships. We're discussing this topic with professor and author Dr. Rock Cotone. He is a professor and coordinator of doctoral programs for the Division of Counseling and Family Therapy at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. He has co-authored the book Counseling, Ethics, and Decision-Making, third edition, with Vilya Tarvitas, and has authored various articles on this subject. Welcome, Dr. Rock Cotone.
Well, hi, Rebecca.
To start things off, I wanted to say that I manned the ACA ethics line while we searched for a new director, and I was amazed at how unclear some of our members are regarding this topic.
It's confusing. It's very confusing.
It's confusing. So I thought I would start by asking you a question on the history of this topic and changes in terminology.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, the story's kind of interesting.
I
had, back in 1998, I was appointed to chair the Commission on Rehab Counselor Certification Task Force, which was charged with rewriting the Code of Ethics for Rehab Counselors. That was a joint committee with the American Rehab Counseling Association. And we were working very hard from 1998 until about 2000 on the Rehab Counseling Code. And I was very proud, really quite proud of the work of the committee. Mm-hmm. After we finished the code, we submitted it to the commission for approval. And one day before it was finally approved by the commission, I sat back and started reading it, and I was very proud and happy to be able to read the work that we'd done. And when we got to the dual relationship, when I got to the dual relationship section of the code, I began to realize that I was in trouble because I was in violation with the code that I just chaired revision of. You know, it was...
You were personally in violation?
Personally in violation.
Tell us in what way.
Well, the interesting part of the story is that I have a son with muscular dystrophy.
Mm-hmm.
My son, Tori, he's now 12, has this dreaded disease, and I've been very, very active in the Muscular Dystrophy Association in terms of raising funds and being an active participant in activities they sponsor for the kids. And, you know, they're Jerry's kids, Jerry
mm-hmm,
Lewis Telethon,
right.
and that sort of thing. So I've always participated in both the social events and the fundraising events of the association. And right before I finished the code revision for the CRCC, I'd written a grant through the University of Missouri, and we obtained funding from a local foundation here to provide services to people with muscular dystrophy. So we did it through the clinic here at the university, and I supervised all of the services that were provided to people that were either affected by muscular dystrophy, family members, or anybody who had connection to the muscular dystrophy community.
Mm-hmm.
So here was the dilemma. I was actively participating in the community, had friends in the community, was at social events in the community, had people over to my house in the community, and at the same time I was serving them as a supervisor of their counseling. So you can imagine the dilemma there.
Right.
That's what would have been called in the past a dual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read the new code that we just finished, and I thought, my goodness, I don't think this is right. And I put my mind to the task trying to figure out what dual relationship really meant, the term, and also tried to figure out whether I was doing anything that technically was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I did is I sat down and figured out that really the word dual relationship can mean three different things.
Mm-hmm.
And it can mean... And I'll just break those down for you, Rebecca, if I can. The first thing it can mean is that it is a sexual or romantic relationship with a client.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a type of relationship that is banned by the code, always has been banned, I shouldn't say always, but in the more recent codes has been banned, and that should be banned.
Banned with current clients, is that correct?
Right. We're talking about romantic and sexual involvement with current clients.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's one type of dual relationship, and that's one that I think most people would agree is harmful.
Yes.
The second type of dual relationship is what I define as non-professional relationships that are outside that romantic sexual relationship category. Mm-hmm. So this might be a situation where you're in the same church with someone who's a client of yours, or you're in some sort of an organization or community where you share membership with a client of yours.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, well, my example with the Muscular Dystrophy Association is a good one,
mm-hmm.
where I'm non-professionally involved with them mm-hmm. As part of the association and working with them to raise funds to fight the disease mm-hmm. and for the kids. And so that's a non-professional mm-hmm. role that I'm playing with them. Mm-hmm. And what I realized was that certain non-professional interactions or relationships really are not harmful, and in fact, mm-hmm. can be potentially beneficial to the client. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I felt that it was probably beneficial to the clients to see that I was actively involved,
mm-hmm.
that we were on the same page in terms of fighting the disease. Mm-hmm. And, I think actually some people did express, thanks to me for being involved, because it demonstrated to them a real commitment, mm-hmm. to the issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second type is the non-professional relationship. And the third type of dual relationship is what I call contiguous professional relationships. And that's really when there's a role change, when you go from, for instance, doing group therapy to individual therapy,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or from doing marital work to individual work, or mm-hmm. vice versa. Any time you change roles with a client, from like mm-hmm. evaluator to therapist, counselor, or from vice versa, from counselor to some kind of an evaluative role,
mm-hmm.
you have what I would call a contiguous professional relationship or a role change.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, those were the three types of relationships that I felt that the old dual relationship term represented.
Hmm.
And I thought those three things were really significantly different,
mm-hmm.
And that the use of the word dual relationship was really not a very clear use of terminology,
mm-hmm.
and that we needed to really revise our thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the Commission of Rehab Counselor Certification, mm-hmm. and I explained my situation to them, and I said, hey, look, I think we need to reconsider this dual relationship standard,
mm-hmm.
and luckily the commission members listened to what I had to say, and then the rehab counseling code that came out in 2002 was the first code to abandon the term dual relationship, mm-hmm. and it added a section on what we would call non-professional
mm-hmm.
relationships with clients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the quick history on how this all came about. I guess the easiest way to say it was I was obviously in violation of the code,
mm-hmm.
and that I felt that I wasn't doing anything wrong or harmful, and mm-hmm. and I tried to show as best as I could that that certain types of relationships like this are tolerable.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, can I ask you a couple of – can I give you a couple of examples, and you could tell me – where they fit in?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. First, and this is an absolutely this is an example of something that has come across my desk in the last year or so, and it was a letter from a counselor, a center director counselor in a college, a small liberal arts college, which I won't mention. She was the center director. This was a rural college, and a young woman who had come there for counseling and was no longer coming there for counseling, had not been there for about 6 months or so for counseling, was applying for a job to work as an administrative assistant or clerk of some sort in the counseling center. There weren't many jobs available on this campus, and so the center director was saying, you know, what do I do? Does this present an ethical dilemma? And if so, which way do I go? So what were your thoughts?
And this was the center's director?
That's correct.
The center director's
client? The center director. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
And so she, you know, I called her up and we had a discussion. And I thought, you know, this really is a dilemma because there's not a million other jobs available for this young lady. She thinks she would do well with this position. But it presents somewhat of a dilemma. So what would be your thoughts be on that particular one?
Well, you know, the code, if you analyze the new code, mm-hmm. it doesn't give you carte blanche permission to start seeking out clients in, mm-hmm. you know, but in non-professional relationships. The code actually directs us to avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're to avoid them unless we have really a compelling reason to do otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question would be, is there a compelling reason here?
Mm-hmm.
Is this client in serious need?
Mm-hmm.
Is this an opportunity if she isn't able to take the opportunity, she's going to suffer some harm or she's
mm-hmm.
going to, you know, not benefit by the actions mm-hmm. of the director? So I think, first of all, you'd have to ask, is there something compelling here that would direct us to engage the client in something
mm-hmm.
non-professional?
Mm-hmm.
And it may be in this case mm-hmm. that there is. You know, maybe the center director feels comfortable with this client working
mm-hmm.
at the center, and once they both talk about it and figure out mm-hmm. all the complications, if there are any, they realize that maybe there really isn't anything that could be a potentially, you know, complicating factor.
Mm-hmm.
And if there isn't a potentially complicating factor, then, you know, they might try it. But
mm-hmm.
they would do this with client permission, and they have to do it in a way that if it isn't working out, that there's kind of what I would call an escape clause.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd say, hey, look, we're going to do this for a trial period.
Mm-hmm.
And if it appears to be uncomfortable for either party, then we'll reassess this, say, in you know, a certain time period. But
I think reason
has to prevail, you know?
Yes. They did something very, very close to what you're describing. And I don't know how it worked out. But yeah, they seem to arrive at a very similar conclusion.
Sure. There would be, you know, now in a large city where there are many jobs,
yes.
you know, the center director might have one of the counselors help assist the client in some vocational counseling or some placement work.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be a different situation if they're in a larger cultural context and a larger, you know, place for employment. And so in that circumstance, there wouldn't be a compelling reason
right.
to engage the client in a non-professional interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, lots of things come up. And in the old days,
yes.
we used to be very cautious. You know, so you're a career counselor,
mm-hmm.
and your client graduates, and they invite you to the graduation party.
Yes.
Now, is that a bad thing to do? No, not at all. I mean, as long as you have the client's permission and the client knows how to handle the fact that you're going to be there, you know,
mm-hmm.
how are you going to be introduced? How will people know that you're invited? And those kinds of facts
mm-hmm.
need to be addressed, I think, before you would attend a ceremony like that.
Just a little interesting aside is years ago, before I was married, I was dating a psychologist, and he asked me if I'd go with him to a wedding that involved two clients. I was not a counselor at that point. I hadn't had graduate education. I didn't really, you know, as a new college graduate from UCLA, I really did not know, you know, much about the field. But I distinctly remember when we walked into the wedding and when we walked into the party afterwards, which I think we only stayed at for 5 minutes, I remember getting this distinct feeling that many of the people felt God had entered. No, they did. I mean, my boyfriend was just, you could just tell they were just, oh, my God, you know,
mm-hmm.
Steve's here. It was just, you know, very amazing. And not knowing anything about, you know, what I know now about the ethics, I do remember that feeling. And I thought, there is sometimes a sense of power that's very unequal.
Yes, and I think the important point is that the therapist or counselor or psychologist
mm-hmm.
you know, really should not exploit that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're going to enter into some kind of a non-professional relationship with a client, that it should be a relationship that's going to benefit the client, that
mm-hmm.
and that there should be no question about exploitation or harm.
That's,
which is a you know, really something that that counselors need to consider, and that's where we get into ethics decision making, and you know, we need to really think through what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And consultation with a client over these matters, I think, is very important in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And another thing, having worked that ethics line, is it seems like a lot of people don't have a consultant relationship set up with somebody who's, say, a peer or a supervisor. And therefore, you know, they call here, for example. But I was always encouraging people to get something like that set up locally, and it doesn't have to cost anything.
No. I have an arrangement with a colleague who works in my office.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of have a little written ethics agreement that we talk about cases that we're really stuck on, you know, mm-hmm. when we're faced with a quandary about either ethical or clinical. And so, you know, you can have an ethics arrangement that limits liability, so to speak, but mm-hmm. also provides you an opportunity to vent on some issues and also to consult
mm-hmm.
over quandaries that you face.
Absolutely.
I think that's a very wise thing to do.
I do, too. And I think some people didn't like the word supervision when I broached this idea of them doing something like that. I said, then just peer consulting. Supervision mm-hmm. reminded them of, you know, being back in school.
Right.
Yeah.
Or being unlicensed.
That's right. You just said, you just spoke briefly about exploitation, which brought me back to one of my questions for you, which is the language. What language should we be using? I saw quite a number of different terms used to describe the things we're talking about today.
You know, I really think we should limit the language.
Okay.
You know, I think exploitation really is a word I try to avoid.
Okay.
You know, what I really focus on when I'm lecturing on this and are talking to groups about this is the issue of harm.
Mm-hmm.
I use the word harm.
Okay.
And we added that to the Code of Ethics, that we do no harm. You know, that's
yeah.
that's a big one. You know, that's an ethical principle that drives back to the Hippocratic Oath, you know, non-maleficence.
Right.
So, you know, I think in terms of ethics, what we're trying to do is we're trying to do good for our clients,
mm-hmm.
and we're trying certainly to avoid harming them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exploitation is hard to define.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some circumstances where we exploit people and it doesn't harm them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can exploit a friendship, for instance, mm-hmm. To some end, and it doesn't harm your friendship.
Like, give us an example.
Well, let's say you meet somebody and you want to get to know them better, so you have your friend help you set up a situation where you can maybe meet or talk to this special person.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of exploitation of the friendship.
Mm-hmm.
To some end, but it's not at all harmful to your friend.
Right. It really doesn't do any harm.
Right. So, you know, I think because exploitation is a motive issue,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, that we really should, you know, it's difficult to define a person's motives. But what we can define is the action of the person and whether the action was in any way detrimental
mm-hmm.
to the client.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use the word harm as the primary kind of standard,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll use the word detriment
mm-hmm.
as a kind of a corollary to that, just to kind of get the point across.
And,
so,
and beneficial as well? Or?
Yeah, beneficial. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're not going to enter into any kind of non-professional relationship with clients unless we feel and we can document
mm-hmm.
In case notes that we think that it's going to be of benefit to the client.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a critical element to the mm-hmm. standard. We're not going to enter into non-professional relationships that are potentially detrimental to the
mm-hmm.
client,
mm-hmm.
or in other words, harmful.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, in terms of really honing the language here and refining it, I would say do away with the word dual relationship, or
mm-hmm.
the other term that's used often is multiple relationship.
Yes.
And focus on what kind it is. Is it a sexual or romantic relationship, in which
mm-hmm.
case it's banned?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a non-professional relationship? Well, we should avoid those, but there are certain circumstances where they could be potentially beneficial, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then we would examine in those cases whether there's potential for harm.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third type is the role change or the contiguous professional relationship, and that happens all the time. And we just need to make sure that we do that in a way that the client is fully aware of the consequences and implications of the role change. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, once we break down the word dual relationship or multiple relationship, those terms, once we break those terms down into those three categories, then it's easier to analyze the behavior and then to make judgments about whether it's harmful or not.
What about going to a client's wedding?
Well, you know, I don't think, again, I think that, first of all, we want to avoid these kinds of circumstances.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Let's say you're, I've had this happen.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of couples counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And I counseled a couple that was Catholic, and they were having trouble. And they through the counseling, they benefited, and they decided to have their vows renewed.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited me to the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And I accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was quite appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with the proviso that I would be introduced a certain way, and actually they had no problem with introducing me as a counselor. Well, you know, in the muscular dystrophy community, people mm-hmm. introduce me typically, and the way they want to be introduced is as a colleague in the community or as a
mm-hmm.
you know, as a parent in the community, so they don't feel uncomfortable about seeking services. But in this case, with the wedding ceremony and a vow renewal, mm-hmm. there was no problem for them to say, you know, this is our counselor, and I was introduced as a counselor. And I didn't go to the party afterwards, but I did go to the
mm-hmm.
ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Felt very comfortable with it, and so did they.
Yeah.
And I think it was a gesture on my part. They certainly felt, expressed appreciation for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like that you determined a language ahead of time. I like that. I think that really...
In what way, Rebecca?
That you said, this is a colleague in the community. That they said, mm-hmm. this is a colleague in the community. I like that
sure.
you got that language clear ahead of time.
Right. Actually, I had another situation where I was counseling a mother of a child that has the same condition my son has.
Mm-hmm.
And my son had a surgery, and she was considering the surgery. It was a heart-wrenching decision for her because mm-hmm. the surgery wasn't considered all that beneficial, but
mm-hmm.
In some ways it was experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so my son had the surgery, and we talked about it, and she made the decision with her son, you know, but she did seek my advice.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the surgery, I went up to the room with her permission to mm-hmm. say hello to her son.
Mm-hmm.
And during the counseling session, I said to her, I said, you know, I'd like to come up and visit at the hospital. And
mm-hmm.
And how do you want to handle if somebody's there?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, just say you're a father of a child with the same condition.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it was really funny because I walked in there and there were family members, her family members there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit of an awkward pause when I walked in, and mm-hmm. I said, hi. You know, I introduced myself, and I said, I'm here for support because my son just went through similar surgery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and after that, things were fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I think, a good thing that we talked about it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
We knew how to handle the circumstance. There shouldn't be any surprises.
Right.
You know, and then the other thing is, if when you're discussing this with a client, if things come up that they describe as uncomfortable, then you shouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's my argument would be avoid it,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And at that point, you could say, gosh, this doesn't sound like it's going to work out too well. Maybe we shouldn't do this,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have a big change here. And,
all right.
And you are a part of this change, and your son has helped you become a part of this change, which is wonderful. How is this new standard different from what we had before?
Well, the old standard just basically said that we avoid dual relationships mm-hmm. whenever possible. I think that's the language, something very close to that.
Right.
And now we have the dual relationship term split out into the three components I defined earlier, and then there's a little bit more room for understanding, and there's a little bit more room for leeway. I think a lot of people were really not abiding by the standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
if you buy Girl Scout cookies from a Girl Scout client, is that mm-hmm. a dual relationship? I mean, those kinds of silly questions came up. You
yeah.
know? And what harm is there? You
exactly.
know, if it's that time of year when you have Girl Scouts selling cookies and you have clients that are Girl Scouts, put an extra $50 away. You know, so.
Mm-hmm.
you can
and that is
some.
What it'll cost, by the way.
yeah, exactly. So, you know, those kind of silly questions really shouldn't come up anymore. I think people should recognize that under certain circumstances they can, you know, purchase a service from a client with strict controls and with their permission so that there's no exploitation or harm.
Right.
So that's the biggest change. You know, and for people who are in communities, especially rural communities or in some sort of closed community, it's more difficult to avoid your clients. You know, it is very hard in certain circumstances to avoid clients when you're in a small town or you're part of a church community or you're an addiction specialist and you have an addiction. You know, those kinds of circumstances now can more easily be addressed by the code because people can say, hey, look, you know, I'm part of this community, and I'm going to be part of this community. I'm not going to walk on eggshells, you know, by nature of my religion or my cultural background or by nature of a condition that I have. So I think the code really gives counselors more flexibility. It also requires that they be very responsible around that flexibility.
Being in a small town is really a different animal. And I've heard that from many of our members who call and talk about various problems. And what you just said reminded me of, I was a brand new counselor. I had just gotten my master's at that point. And I was working in a small town in Oregon. And I remember I was standing in the grocery store, you know, checking out to see if any of the eggs were cracked in my box. And somebody came up and said, I've needed to talk to you about my son all week. You know, and it's a different world. It's a different world than when you're in a big town where that is so unlikely to happen.
Right, right.
And how do all of these changes, what do they mean for counseling in general? And I guess more specifically, I think about privacy.
Well, you know, I think as the profession matures and evolves, it requires more intellectual work and more responsibility on the part of the professional. You know, I think when you have to make decisions, high-level decisions about critical issues related to a client, that really is, you know, it's a sign that we've achieved professional status, that we're not just, you know, that we're not just workers, you know, putting concrete blocks on top of each other. The real intellectual decision-making has to occur. And so I think that's, you know, that's a good thing. It means to me that the profession has arrived, you know. Because we're really using our knowledge base and our tradition and our history as a profession to guide us, and that's a very good thing. I mean, look at medicine. I mean, the Hippocratic Oath was in the 4th century BC, or at least they think it was written around then. So, I mean, they've been guided by some standards since way back then, you know.
And above all, do no harm has been in there from the beginning, hasn't it?
Right, right. Yeah, the terms beneficence and non-maleficence.
Those terms are tricky, by the way.
They are tricky, yeah.
I've met about 4 people who can pronounce it correctly.
Yes, exactly.
But that just to me means that they're probably not the right words.
You know? Well, I mean, you know, the whole idea is do good and avoid harm. Those are the basic concepts that derive from those fancy terms. So
do good and avoid harm,
So, you know, I think it's an evolution of the profession that we've reached the point where we really have to think through what we do and that we're a thoughtful profession, that we're trained as intellectuals, essentially. We're all graduate-trained people, and so this is an exciting time, I think, for the profession.
It is an exciting time. Going to a very practical question, in terms of your informed consent and your confidentiality agreements, do they need a change with these changes?
Well, you know,
or have they changed?
For my situation, it's easy. You can't anticipate every possible, you know, non-professional interaction that can arise with a client.
Right.
But for me, since I'm part of a community and I work with people in the community as a counselor, it's fairly easy. So I have a statement on my informed consent form saying, you know, hey, I'm a member. I have a son with muscular dystrophy. I'm a member mm-hmm. of the community. Mm-hmm. We may come into contact in some social, non-professional context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, please be aware of this. If you have a problem with this, you know, please bring it to my attention before mm-hmm. we begin counseling. And mm-hmm. and then I ask them, you know, when they come in, I say, you know, how would you like to handle it if I should see you at, you know, a fundraiser mm-hmm. or, you know, at a social event.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people generally don't have much of a problem with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I've never had somebody walk out the door and say, well, I'm not going to do this.
Right. It's interesting, though. It's been a long time since I've been in private practice, but when I was, I remember saying as part of my initial interview when we were getting to know each other, I would say, and by the way, if I see you in the community, I'm not going to say hello, but you can come up and say hello if you want. But the reason I'm not going to say hello is because I don't want you to have to explain to the person you're with how you know me.
Right.
And
right.
most people like that. Most people said, that's mm-hmm. a good, I'm glad you brought that up ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I'm glad we, you know. But every now and then somebody wouldn't, and they'd say, no, I want you to say hello. I said, okay, I will.
Sure.
That's fine with me. But I just want you to know that you have an option.
Right. You know, and I actually have that on the informed consent form. I say, you know, if I should meet you in the community,
mm-hmm.
I'll approach you as a parent of a child in the community, and mm-hmm. I won't acknowledge your client status unless you do so first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's the way it's written in the mm-hmm. in the informed consent section.
And since you're teaching new counselors along with all the other stuff you do, how are they taking this change, or do they even see it as a change? Because
they really don't see it as a change.
Okay.
You know, for them, it's the standard. It's been in place since 2005. They're all new students. And
mm-hmm.
So I think some of them are looking at it as just, this is the way it is. And, you know, we use our brains when we have to figure these things out, and that we avoid situations that are compromising, but certainly we're not going to try and, you know, run away from our clients if we see them at the supermarket.
Exactly, exactly. What else do our members need to know? We have a large membership of master's-level clinicians who are working hard in agencies all day long. And what else do they need to know from you today?
Well, I mean, this is not opening a floodgate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you really look at the standard, mm-hmm. It's asking you to avoid these kinds of interactions. Michael Cosette, who was the chair of the ACA task force that rewrote the Code of Ethics, that's now the 2005 Code of Ethics,
right.
He and I gave a presentation at an ACA conference, and mm-hmm. that was a major theme of the presentation. Even though we were talking about potentially beneficial relationships, mm-hmm. we really tried to stress the idea that this is not opening the floodgate, mm-hmm. you know, that we're really wanting people to avoid these circumstances, but mm-hmm. many people have compelling reasons to enter in mm-hmm. to non-professional relationships, and in those cases, there's room for forethought.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, really, I think counselors and counselor educators, supervisors, mm-hmm. Need to recognize that they shouldn't be seeking friendships from their client.
Mm.
The relationships, the non-professional relationships that are fair to enter should be time-limited mm-hmm. or context-specific.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the most recent rewrite of the Rehab Counseling Code, mm-hmm. we added that terminology.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't want people to get the idea that, hey, you can be a friend with your client now. Mm-hmm. This is not about friendship. I mean, find your friends outside
yes.
of those few clients that you see.
Yes.
You know, there are 7 billion people on this earth.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can find a friend somewhere else. You don't have to find a friend with your client or your former student necessarily. Or actually, a former student, it really isn't as much of a conflict. But
right, right.
Or, you know, but with clients, we really shouldn't be seeking friendships, long-term relationships with these people. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, we need to have a life outside, and we need to seek
right.
friendships and establish relationships outside. So, you know, the terminology, I think, with the newest Rehab Counseling Code, which hasn't mm-hmm. been approved yet, we just finished work on that.
Oh, okay.
Just last month, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we added that it should be time-limited and context-specific
mm-hmm.
so that you're not looking in long-term, establishing long-term relationships with people.
Right. I want to hit on just for a minute the romantic relationships. You know, again, I'll go back to my my time of manning the ethics line, and a woman called me one day, and she said, you know, I've been a counselor forever, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I feel I'm falling in love with a client. And I, you know, there was part of me that was like, that wanted to say, stop it, you know?
Yeah, right.
What are you doing, you know?
But you know what? You can't control emotions.
Exactly.
You really can't control
exactly.
emotions, you know,
exactly.
and but we can control our actions.
Yes.
So, I mean, there have been many studies that have shown that counselors, psychotherapists, psychologists do have feelings for their clients, sometimes
mm-hmm.
romantic feelings for their clients.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not unusual for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where does one go with that? Well,
right.
obviously, one should follow one's code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And the code says, hey, look, you don't cross the line here
right.
with clients from a romantic or sexual
mm-hmm.
standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And so acknowledging the feelings and dealing with those in terms of one's own therapy, one's,
mm-hmm.
one's own colleagues and
mm-hmm.
support system, I think, is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And controlling actions is the critical variable there. We don't want somebody to cross the line or play games around that.
Right. And
you know, that we had a heck of a debate over the code of ethics related to that. Because
did you?
There have been
tell us.
Well, I mean, some people are saying, hey, look, you know, you can't restrict the freedom of adults to enter into relationships with each other. I mean, that's a mm-hmm. right in our culture. We have the right
mm-hmm.
to associate.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be able to associate with whom we want and when we want and how we want,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's a powerful argument,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
that we're talking about adults. But the problem for counselors is that we're working with vulnerable people in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
We also work with some people who may be malicious and may actually seek to do harm to us.
Yes.
You know, that's another side of the story. But.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take the vulnerable client, you know, that let's take that case. We don't want to do harm to someone. If we know a person's most intimate history
mm-hmm.
and we could use that to our own sexual benefit,
mm-hmm.
then that's scary.
Yes,
that's
it is.
Really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's not a code of ethics in the mental health area that allows for that kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we have rights, you know, mm-hmm. rights by law here in the United States, we don't have the right to harm people.
Right.
So
right.
the argument that we have the right to associate is powerful, but
mm-hmm.
it also has to be juxtaposed to the responsibility not to do harm to people.
That's right.
And when we're in a professional relationship with someone, I think it holds us to a higher standard.
And I think we almost need to dust off Freud and talk about transference and countertransference again. You know, it's something nobody talks about those words anymore, but that's a part of it.
Well, it really speaks to the power of relationships,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people that are most vulnerable as professionals are those that are not linked to a healthy system of support,
mm-hmm.
who isolate themselves in their offices,
right.
That are not connected to the professional community,
mm-hmm.
I think those people become very vulnerable. And,
this woman who called, you know, there was a part of me, of course, that wanted to say stop it. And there's another part of me that said, she's human.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell she's embarrassed to be called. But good for her that she's calling and talking
yeah.
to somebody about it. And she actually said, well, I'm reading the Code of Ethics right now, and it seems that if I wait 5 years, I can actually do this. And I thought, wow, is that really how she's thinking about it? What about the 5-year piece? What do you think about that?
actually, that was partly me too,
mm-hmm.
because I argued in favor of the 5-year ban and
okay.
And introduced it.
Why 5 years?
Well, it was again the message is these people are off limits.
Yes.
You know, find your sexual partners out there someplace else, you know.
Right.
Find your lovers and your romantic friends, romantic relationships
mm-hmm.
somewhere else. Like I said, there's 7 billion people on this earth. Certainly you can find somebody to love you
yes.
Outside of the few hundred people that you've counseled in your career. So
right.
To me, it's kind of a pathetic situation
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
if someone is so isolated and so unconnected to the community that they mm-hmm. the only people they can find to love would be those people that they they counsel. That's a very sad situation from my perspective.
And what is love? Is love being idealized? Because many will do that. They will, you know, they will idealize
right.
you.
Right. And so, you know, I guess my point is, and, you know, there was full agreement on the committee about this. We really didn't argue this one much, and that was that we should banish for 5 years. Most of the codes, most of the professions are moving to that ban, and some are banning them. I think the American Psychiatric Association has banned it into perpetuity, meaning you never, ever have a relationship with a client, which is another consideration that we had.
Yeah, but, and why did you not go with that? What was the,
well, again, I mean, the freedom. We felt 5 years was a good period of time to separate people from any emotions that they had at the time, and that it looked less exploitive the further you got out from the actual counseling relationship, and there was much less potential for harm. You know, so, you know, in the end, it was a compromise. It was a consensus.
I see.
There are very few cold, hard facts on this. I mean, there is much anecdotal evidence that it's harmful. And there have been a few studies that have shown detriment to, to clients. And so it's hard to just find a hard piece of evidence that says, hey, there's this is unquestionably wrong and harmful. There's a lot that points that direction. So in the end, it was a consensual kind of decision.
Yeah, that's, you know, we have to come together in the spirit of compromise if we're going to do any of this. So it sounds like that's what you all did.
Well, the message was, hey, look, this is, this, we should avoid this sort of stuff. This is not good for the profession. It's not good for our clients. And it's not healthy for us either.
Anything else that our listeners need to know about this really important topic?
Yes, I would add another point, Rebecca, and that is something that, that we added to the newest rehab counseling code, which probably will be approved and come out next year. I'm assuming about 2010 that it'll be finally approved. We added a proviso that there are certain clients that are off limits forever. And we identified the type of client, for instance, the mentally retarded, the severely cognitively impaired, severe personality disturbances, those kinds of clients. We added a section basically saying, hey, there's no five-year limit. There's a forever limit on certain types of clients because it just looks too too bad for the profession if someone should be involved with somebody in that, in those categories.
Well, and a lot of people know a story, and I certainly, I worked in an inpatient psychiatric facility once, and there was a psychiatrist there who was being, well, let's just say that a borderline was really trying to destroy his life after he had had a relationship with her. And once you see that, you don't have to see much more. She was really, really scary in what she was trying to do for, to him. And he kept telling all of us, learn a lesson from me. That was a mistake. I should not have done it. Blah, blah, blah. You know, things were slightly different back then. I think it was 1 year. And he, you know, it was still, but this was a serious personality disturbance.
Right. I think any counselor who gets involved in a situation like that is asking for trouble. And, and you know, it just, it feeds into the sickness of the client, and it does harm to the client, and it certainly can backfire on the counselor and you know. So it's there are certain circumstances I think we can agree are such that we should avoid any contact with clients of that nature forever.
I think that's a good idea. I like that caveat. I would I look forward to reading it when it comes out. Well, I'm going to draw our interview to a close, and I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today about this really important topic.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Rebecca. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk about this. It's something obviously I'm impassioned about. So
you really are, and our readers can go to our webpage, and they'll be able to see some links to things you have written. Thank you so much, Dr. Rock Cotone, for joining us today to discuss this timely and important topic. To view links to this program or to write to the presenter or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2009 podcast series, signing off.